Hi, and welcome to the Dallas Soccer Show. I'm Dustin Nation. I'm here again with Tristan Vick. How's it going, Tristan?
It's going well.
Tristan, why don't you tell us a little bit about what we got planned for this show?
Yeah, this show is going to be one big, long interview with our resident world football phone-in celebrity, the Neymar, if you listen to that BBC podcast or radio show, John Arnold. He covers Liga MX, U.S. soccer, a little bit MLS, and we really touch on all sorts of things, starting with FC Dallas and the 2018 roster moves, and move into Liga MX and the differences and the similarities between soccer development here in the United States as well as in Mexico. And at the end, you might want to stay tuned because we get a little bit into whether or not Donald Trump will ever own an MLS franchise.
The answer may or may not surprise you.
That's right. Let's get to that interview.
All right, here it is, folks. You're listening to the Dallas Soccer Show with Dustin Nation and Tristan Vick. All right, today we have a special guest with us. He writes for Goal.com, the Dallas Morning News, and you can find him on the BBC World Football phone-in or in Mexico covering Liga MX. Of course, I'm talking about John Arnold. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome. Yeah, when we were planning out our off-season shows, and I was asking Tristan about who we should have on the show, he gave me two names. He gave me John Arnold and Tim Vickery. And so we're super glad you're able to make it on the show tonight.
My pleasure. I'll put in a word for Tim as well, if you guys haven't snagged him already.
No, yeah, absolutely. He's a big fan of FC Dallas and the South Americans, so I'm sure he would be able to talk about it.
All right. Well, so stay tuned, folks. All right. So we've got a lot to talk about tonight. We're kind of recording this in between the Toronto-Columbus match and the Liga MX playoff match that John's going to be writing about later on. So that leaves us with a pretty short window. So let's go ahead and get stuck in. All right. So let's start with FC Dallas. We've kind of gone over the 2017 season a lot on this show. And I know, John, you were recently on the 19th minute with Stephen Davis and Mark Folliwell talking about the same thing. That was really entertaining episode, by the way. That sounded like a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a good time. Look, any time that, like, and hopefully, I mean, I think this will be the same sort of conversation that we're having. Like, soccer, it's fun, right? It's a sport, and that's why we like watching it, because it's, like, fun. And I'm not trying to say, like, oh, yeah, stick to sports, like, no politics in soccer, because there are a ton of politics. That's part of the reason I think we love the game. But, like, anytime you can sort of have a discussion that's, like, less serious than a lot of the stuff that, you know, TV or even the football, the world football phone-in, like, it's a pretty casual environment, but at the same time, it's like, you know, we're all over the country, the world rather, and Skyping in. So anytime you can sort of like sit face to face and just, I mean, literally just have a pint and chat with your buddies, it's a great opportunity. So I'm glad that we were able to do that, and hopefully can sort of emulate that here tonight.
Yeah, that's kind of how we started the show. Tristan and I are brother-in-laws, and anytime we'd get together with our families, we just would start talking about soccer, and we just decided to start recording.
Nice.
So, yeah. So let's put the 2017 season behind us. I'm ready to forget it. Anybody else with me?
I think most fans are.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and start talking about the 2018 roster. FC Dallas just released their option decisions and their roster for the upcoming MLS dates. Any surprises on the decisions they made this year for this one, John?
I wasn't too surprised by anything. I think part of that is just being sort of around the team. But I think you also saw a lot of the guys who weren't retained last year, a lot of them struggled. You know, when you look at Atiba Harris, a guy who was much beloved at the club, but probably wasn't even supposed to have as big of a role as he did last year. Going into the season, injuries to various players and suspensions and what have you sort of forced him into this role that I don't think he was ever supposed to have as sort of a starting center back. You know, in some ways, I think you have to praise him for how quickly he adapted to it. But in other ways, you never want that to happen for a guy like Atiba. It's a rough situation, I think, to put him in. So I wasn't surprised. And it sounds like he sort of hinted on Twitter that he might stick around with the club in maybe a different capacity. other than that, I mean, you look at the guys, a lot of guys who were on loan that didn't play much. Hernan Grana was the same way where, okay, yeah, he contributed a lot and was a regular starter last year. But going into the season, you know, FC Dallas wanted Jose Salvatierra, the Costa Rican, to be their starting right back, sort of ended up falling into having Grana there. I think he kind of ran out of steam at the end of the year. And I'm not sure personally he really, you know, he's got a family. I don't know that he wants to be up here long term. He's an older guy as far as soccer players go. Nice story, nice guy, had a good year, but I don't think it's too stunning not to see him back. And I think you'd say those are maybe the two most surprising names on the list. The other thing that really stuck out to me about sort of the news release was that Minor Figueroa, while he's not coming back yet, the club kind of seems to want to bring him back. I asked him, I asked Oscar Pareja, and a couple other people around the club about how sort of Honduras making or not making, and it obviously ended up not making the World Cup, would sort of affect his status. I think if they were in the World Cup, if he was sort of training, I think he would have wanted to go to another club. But now I think he might be more open to staying with FC Dallas because I think that they see him in sort of a substitute everything role. You can play him at left back, you can play him at center back. If you really needed to, I guess you could play him a right back. But, you know, clearly on the left side of defense is a strength. Now, you don't necessarily have to get him the minutes that I think he would have needed if he were trying to be the captain of a team that's going to the World Cup. It's not the situation that he wanted, and I don't think it's a situation that you root for him to have, because I think you would have liked to see a guy like that go to the World Cup and sort of have one last hurrah. But that was one thing that sort of stuck out to me on the release. I'm sure Minor will end up somewhere. I'm not 100% sure it'll be with FC Dallas because, you know, there's still a bit of ways to go, I think, between the salary that he probably wants and the salary the club probably wants to give him. But those were the big things that stood out for me, looking at sort of the decisions the team made.
Yeah. Hey, so Tristan, did you see any roster surprises there?
Yeah. So the only thing I would add is I thought it was a little bit surprising that they marked that down. I do, like John, wonder that Figueroa, whether or not they would have tried to negotiate with him if they had made the World Cup. I think that would have been a little bit of asking for trouble because we saw how much international breaks made this season seem like so much of a stop, start, restart, figure it out again, get the team that works well together, and then you have another break that interrupts that flow, that progress that a team has. And so I wasn't expecting anything very different from what we saw. I'm more interested in what they're going to do at the left back and right back positions going forward. I think those are the two sneaky offseason moves that can kind of make or break next season. So I would be looking and interested in knowing what they're going to do for those two roles specifically.
Yeah, it's interesting that we're talking so much about the defense here. Big D Soccer just published an article about what are we going to be doing with the defense next season. Looks like we've got a need for at least one more center back. We may be going, like they were speculating, you know, that we may be doing three at the back or something completely different. What areas do you think that you would strengthen if you were Pareja or Clavejo, John?
I think I would definitely start at center back. I think it's unsung, and you know you're not going to see any team in the league buy a DP center back. But it's no accident that Toronto was as good as they were this year with some of the center back play they got out of a guy like Drew Moore and even Justin Morrow, you know, is that part of that sort of three man back line they were rolling with or are rolling with, I guess, as they're still alive in the playoffs. Even you look at Columbus, who they're playing against, you know, pretty solid, consistent back line. Seattle with Chad Marshall and Roman Torres. And even Houston, you know, one of the other semifinalists. They got some injuries that hurt them, but having De La Garza at right back and having Machado in there regularly, that's an off-season addition they made. And I think that's a good point. You mentioned sort of sneaky. Yeah, like I said, you're not going to go out and buy some guy for $1 million. But if you can get a solid veteran CONCACAF defender like Torres, like Machado, I think it goes a long way toward success. And when you even look at FC Dallas's season 2 years ago, they got, I think, above average play from both Hedges and Zimmerman, and it made all the difference. You know, that was maybe the difference between the team winning the Supporters Shield and being, you know, the third or fourth place team in the West. I think this year was the difference between the team making the playoffs and not making the playoffs, that you didn't have that center back play. Walker Zimmerman will be a huge question. But either way, even if Zimmerman improves or gets out of the doghouse or whatever is going on, gets that sort of situation figured out and returns to the level, I think you still need a much better third center back option or first center back option, you know, and sort of bump Hedges and Zimmerman down the depth chart if you can do that. So I start at center back. Then I probably look at, I don't know, forward or wing. Max Cerruti faded down the stretch, and who knows if he's going to be back. Just because, you know, he's still under contact with FC, doesn't mean he's not going to go somewhere else this winter. But just because you have Roland Lamas and Michael Barrio still under contract, I don't think that means those guys need to be your starting wingers. And if you're going to play the same system, I think you need more production off specifically the left side, which is what Lamas was sort of brought in to do to replace Fabian Castillo. And I, despite the fact that he ran up a decent amount of goals, I was never convinced and remain unconvinced that he's a guy who can do that for FC Dallas. So I think maybe I would go center back and then left winger. And fullbacks are a concern, but I, as much as that was a problem this year, I think it's something that maybe you can sort of have further down the priority list.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I'm wondering, at least on fullback, how much of a role Reggie Cannon's going to get this year, or if we're going to go out and get somebody to go there and he'll kind of be the backup again.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he showed well in training as far back as the CONCACAF Champions League game. So, you know, he was looking solid, wasn't able to displace Grana from the starting role in Oscar Pereja's eyes. But it also sounds like for sure we're going to see a shift this season. We're going to see some of those young guys who weren't able to get minutes. I think we're going to see sort of a maybe return to roots for FC Dallas, whether that means they're not, you know, challenging for the supporters shield or not winning tournaments, but are getting experience for these teenagers. You know, I think that's a trade-off that FC Dallas fans might be willing to take, especially after this year. They sort of stuck with a lot of the experienced players and it didn't end up working out well for them. So it's going to be fascinating. I think Cannon's a great point as a guy who maybe the club has plans for him already to slot into that right back spot. Anibal Chala is another interesting situation because I don't know that he's in the club's future plans, but he could, again, sort of slot in as a young left back on that side. So it'll be very fascinating to see the approach they take. I just, when you say what's the first thing the team needs, I think you look at center back instead of the outside backs, not only because I think the team worse off might be a harsh thing, but I think just needs that more. I think it's also just because of the market. It's sort of easy. You can sort of get away with, especially in MLS, a league where pretty much no one seems to have good fullbacks, you can sort of get away with having that as third or fourth or fifth on your priority list.
I mean, if the push comes to shove, we'll just put Hollingshead back there wherever he needs to go.
Yeah. I mean, all right. Absolutely. Yeah, it's not like a beautiful situation. I don't think that's what they want to do. But like, I mean, no. I think it's we're sort of highlighting the fact that as nice as it would be to have great fullbacks in MLS, very few teams do.
What about all of the players that were released? Are there any players out there that are now free agents that are tempting for you to go after if you're Clavejo?
Oh, man. To be honest, I didn't even look at the list.
I tried to. And then you sit there and you think about it and you're thinking, I'm looking at one league's free agency list and there's how many leagues that we can. So,
well, I mean, I think it also speaks to FC Dallas's defenders. Yeah. It also speaks to FC Dallas's strategy, right? While they are willing to bring in a guy like Javier Morales, you know, in the off season and enjoy having someone with MLS experience, even signing Carlos Ruiz in the middle of the 2015 season, you know, a guy with MLS experience who clearly didn't have much gas left in the tank and then scored a very crucial goal. They're far more concerned about, you know, A, developing their own players, but B, finding guys in the South American market who can be good value players and can fill those spots. So it's entirely possible that they pick up one or two guys, but I think they'll be way more active in the foreign market as sort of is their tendency.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I figure as much. All right. So I was going to get your thoughts kind of off of this, but Oscar Pereja, and you've talked about it and Tim's talked about it on the phone in, the way that he has kind of melded this South American feel with the emphasis on the academy and developing some talent. Do you feel like that he's properly assessed and rightly valued in the approach he takes to the team? Do you think it's a little overblown at times? Has he kind of struck gold with a couple of players? Or do you think in some cases we're undervaluing or giving him the benefit of a doubt for the job that he's done, setting up that first team and then to balancing that development for players like Kellen and I guess Paxton and Coy are some of the next up there?
I think it was a really tough year for Pareja because I think he was sort of asked to, on the one hand, keep his strategy and style of developing players and bringing young players from the academy, something that he loves doing because he himself was brought in at a young age. You know, he's told the story several times of playing Colombia and having a coach put trust in him when he was a teenager. He then moved after his playing career was integral in the FC Dallas Academy growing to be what it is today and saw how good some of those kids were. And I think, you know, feels confident putting in players when he feels ready. So he was on one hand asked to do that, to continue to cultivate this academy system, these young players, but on the other hand was asked to win the MLS Cup with these additions, right? By, you know, using these players who had been brought in with big money. And I'm not saying those things are mutually exclusive necessarily, but I do think it's a very difficult balance to strike. And I'm not sure that anyone could have gotten it right. That being said, he didn't get it right. He didn't find the right balance. And now FC Dallas is looking back at a year where not only they didn't make the playoffs, not only do they not have any silverware to hold up, but they also got less than 90 minutes, I want to say, for the four teenagers that they signed before the season. So I think it was, again, a difficult ask of Oscar Pareja. I think it might have been... It's just a tough place for him to be in. But I think when you look at his overall body of work, he definitely deserves credit for it. Not only how he's been able to develop some young players, but also, as you mentioned, melding the styles and bringing some of the Colombian ideas, South American ideas, to a United States development system and a United States first team system even that I think is far off in speaking in English and not understanding any of the sort of Latino Spanish sort of tradition of the sport, ideas that the sport has, you know, going and studying under Jorge Sampaoli when he was at Sevilla. You know, not every coach has the opportunity to do that, but I think it's great that he was able to take that and sort of learn from those concepts. Some of the other coaches that he's talked about learning from, studying, all the football that he watches, I think it does sort of bring in an interesting element that other coaches don't have. And I think that, you know, do we give him too much credit for it? Do we give him not enough credit for it? I'd say right now, I feel like we sort of give him the right amount of credit. I think he's a coach that's well-respected in the league. I think he's a coach that's well-respected, even to some extent on the global scale, although he's not as big of a name in South America as some of his counterparts. But, you know, coaching is based on results, and he'd tell you the same thing. You know, he's well aware that if the team continues to not make the playoffs, it doesn't matter how many young players' minutes he gets, he won't have a job, and he'll tell you that himself. So I think this is a huge season for him, and it'll be fascinating to see just how much sort of wiggle room he's given to sort of, I guess, do his own thing. Because I think this past year, maybe that wasn't the case. I think there were maybe influences elsewhere, or maybe influences he felt, even if they were imagined, to play these guys who were brought in. Lamar earning the second most amount of money on the team. Colman, the biggest ever DP signing. Well, he didn't play him that much, but I think there was some pressure both inside Oscar Pareja's mind and within the club's setup to sort of try and make that work, and he wasn't able to. So it's an enormous season for him coming up, and I think one that will sort of either cement his reputation as sort of a quiet genius or perhaps, you know, reveal that, hey, you know, maybe this isn't where his strength is necessarily, or he had a run as good as he could have with this team, and now it's time to move on and explore another project. You know, it's an enormous year for him. Personally, I think he's great. He's a great human. He's great with the media. And I think he's a really good coach. I still believe that he's going to have a good year. But, you know, the proof will be in the pudding for him.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. I mean, I've never talked to the guy, but I've seen him at a couple of academy matches I went to. And then watching some of the post-match interview videos that they post, you could see it as the season went on, the confusion in his eyes. It was stressful, obviously, because they were on such a bad losing streak at the end. But it was also more of a confused, like, I've tried this and that, and nothing I'm trying is working. Whereas when I did these moves last year, it got results. And so, yeah, I could see the frustration. He's very, for a South American, he does stay fairly calm.
That's true.
We'll say that.
Yeah, for the most part. But, you know, like, there's the, you know, for every staying calm moment, there's also, like, a Caleb Porter hanky waving Right. You know, there's always like one or two, like you kind of see a little gamesmanship come through now and then. There's a little bit of paranoia, I think, sometimes that I definitely think comes from the sort of Latin American school where like his trainings are sort of open. But like if there's someone there, it's like, who is that guy? Why is that guy here? You know, is that a scout from the San Jose Earthquakes? Exactly. It's like, man, the Earthquakes don't have money to sign, you know, a forward. I don't think they're going to send a scout to Frisco and put him up in a, you know, hotel. Right. But you know, it is funny. And that is something that, again, I think comes from sort of that school. So some of that still runs deep, you know, those Colombian roots. And like I said, I think that's almost always a good thing, but sort of manifests itself sometimes in a little bit of fire now and then.
Sure, sure. So off that, going from the academy with the senior team, bringing in some players, I'm just kind of curious, if you go through and look through the development academy rosters for FC Dallas, some last names stand out. And so you've got guys like Marco Ferruzzi, one of the coach's kids on the team. You have Oscar's child. You have a number of other players' kids on that team. You mentioned that Grana has a family. Do you think that Frisco, which, I mean, FC Dallas is notorious for horrible attendances, but Frisco itself is a great place for players that want to maybe actually put down some roots. Do you think that has had some sort of a benefit for their academy system, since while a player may move on for the club, the family kind of likes the area, and so they stick around and their kid plays for the academy? Have you seen anything like that in any of the other MLS clubs, or maybe even in Mexico, where it's a more suburban, family-friendly atmosphere around the club?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, you didn't even mention Jesus Ferreira.
Yeah.
Atiba's kids play. Morales.
Minor Figueroa has a kid,
Minor has some
too.
Really young kids that are, you know, the next great Hunter and Hope.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's some about Frisco and the facilities that they have, but it's also a lot about the club. And I think you do see that manifested in other places around the league and around the continent. You know, if a father is able to feel good and have his son or daughter in an academy that teaches well and that they like the instruction and that sort of thing, especially when they're at that stage of their career, you know, 34, 35, and those things start to matter a lot more than, can I go out and party? Or not even that, but, you know, am I living in a cool city? Am I, you know, can I go to the museum? Can my wife go to a fancy store? You know, when you're 35, 36, 37, not everyone, but, you know, once you have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old, it becomes a lot more important of what's my kid's future than am I having a good time, I think. I don't speak from experience, but that's, you know, sort of the impression that you get talking to people. You guys probably know better than me, yeah?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, Dustin's got three of them. I've got two of them. So.
Wait, 3-2. Okay, so
he's got three. I've got
six
two,
more,
yeah.
And you've got a starting 11.
Yeah, they're all girls.
Six too. More, and you've got an all girls team, man. That's great.
Yeah, no, it's we're well on our way. Well, I've got nieces, so we got
bring them in.
Set.
Yeah, I'm not right. coaching, but, you know, I'm sure you can find somebody. No, but, you know, in Mexico, you do see that as well, where it's I think it's just about the family feel of the club. Club Tijuana, very far from other Mexican clubs. They've had a couple, like the Arces, Fernando Arce's son, Fernando Arce Jr., was actually born in San Diego and has been involved with some of the U.S. youth teams. You know, he's come up through that system, mm-hmm. and I think it's just about the comfort that they feel there. You know, they found a place they like to live. It was the end of this Arce Senior's career, and he, you know, was comfortable with his son being in the system. And it also depends on how quickly the kid is coming up too. But yeah, I mean, I think more than Frisco, although the facilities there are great, and I think it's a city where players, again, of a certain age, like to live. More than that, I just think it's the family feel around the club and the fact that there really is a unity that I think is fostered by Pareja and the Bazan brothers and Ferruzzi. You know, I think the coaching staff is enormous in sort of fostering that feeling for players from any background, you know, with any situation. And I think that's manifested itself in youth players, but also just the first team enjoying each other's company and generally being good. You know, you look back at this last season, and I think there was maybe a little bit of not a rift in the locker room necessarily, but there were just a lot of little distractions that sort of did add up, I think.
I think the way Tristan put it is that it seemed like everybody had their own goals for the season, and it was really hard to mesh those goals together.
Yeah, I mean, even... Yeah, like I said, I think the family feel has been so big, and I'm not trying to say that wasn't there this year, but I don't think it was as easy for the coaches to foster as it has been in previous seasons. And part of that is, like you mentioned, the international absences. I do think that there is some, you know, different, yeah, maybe differing individual goals, that kind of thing. So anyway, all that to say, I don't know about the location necessarily, but I think the feel around the club and the comfort that players feel is an enormous factor in you know, feeling comfortable putting their kids in the system. And even, you know, in the case of Jesus and David Ferreira, like, David's like, well, I'm gonna go play in Colombia again, like, see you later. So, I mean, you know, you have to be pretty confident and believe in the FC Dallas system to do that, right? So I think that speaks to the atmosphere and the environment that the club has, a lot of it because of the coaching staff.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I went, my kids were out of town for a weekend. And so I spent, when they played Lone Star SC, I went and watched a couple of the matches and just hanging out. And yeah, the whole coaching staff was there for the U19 team match. And then there were tons of everybody who goes and watches. When their match is over, they go back to the locker room, change, they go and watch the next match. Definitely got that feel. So it's good to see that. I mean, that's kind of makes sense then that you can move on and feel comfortable leaving your kid there. Let's transition from Frisco, who has missed out on a couple of players leaving for another league, Liga MX, which you've obviously been covering pretty heavily for the past few years. But let's skip Dustin's obvious question about why we need to watch the MLS Liga MX playoffs, because I think we can figure that one out. But going into the two semifinals, right, we've got some playoffs here. Can you want to break them down? Do you think Monterrey is still an overwhelming favorite based on their performance so far, not just through the season, but through the playoffs? Or are we going to maybe see an upset in the cards here? Maybe probably not in the semis, but maybe in the final?
It's Monterrey's to lose. They were the best attack all year in Liga MX. They were the best defense. They play an interesting style, because normally when you think of a great attack, I think you think of, especially nowadays, you know, you think of a possession style and moving the ball and, you know, 75% possession and 28 chances and 10 shots on goal. Monterrey is like, nah, we don't really want the ball, and we're not really going to string together passes. Like, we are going to do some crazy passes, but they're going to be really risky. They have like the worst or the second worst cumulative passing percentage, because they just try these like wild, not, maybe that's not entirely fair. Like, they're not like trying to bicycle kick it from midfield up to the forward or anything, but like they're low percentage, low, you know, just risky passes.
Right.
And yeah, it's sort of high risk, high reward, because then they play these balls, and when they do get through, Aviles Hurtado or Rogelio Funes Mori has this easy goal, or, you know, a one-on-one situation with the goalkeeper. And their defense has been really good too. So it's interesting. Yeah, I think they're the absolute favorite. The title definitely goes through Monterrey, and partly too because Tigres has been good, although not great. But finished second in the regular season. So I'm sort of, I think the whole neutral faction of Mexico soccer is rooting for a Clásico Regio, both games played in Monterrey, yeah, just because it'd be pretty sweet. So
yeah. So that's the first one. And I've been watching them, and I would agree with you. It's almost like a mixture between the counterattacking style and then just really clean passes,
and
kind of
pressure.
How Arsenal does it.
Yeah, it is counterattacking, but I think a lot of times when we think of counterattack, we think of, you know, 10 guys in their own half, and then as soon as they get the ball, they push forward. But one thing they do is the forwards pressure. So they're not just standing statically. It's just that when they do win the possession back, they're not immediately recycling the ball and trying to keep it for 3 minutes. As soon as they win the ball, they're trying to find a shot. So it ends up, it's fun to watch, because it ends up in long shots and, you know, like I said, these like wild opportunities created out of nowhere that end up in shots, either saved or goals. So it doesn't fit in a conventional style necessarily. And Antonio Mohamed, to his credit, the coach of Monterrey, has never really had sort of a traditional style. When he was coaching Tijuana, that was when I first started writing about Liga MX, and he played this Edgar Castillo, the American, who's still at Monterrey, although I don't think for much longer, because he's lost his starting job. He's rumored to be coming to MLS, but Edgar Castillo was in name the left back, but essentially they were playing like a three-man back line shifted over, where like Castillo would track back if he needed to, but mostly he was halfway up the field as sort of an extra winger. So he's always done these sort of interesting and risky things. Sorry, I got distracted. The question being, is Monterrey the favorite? It's theirs to lose, but it also was theirs to lose, I think, in the Apertura it's very confusing. The Clausura a couple years ago when Pachuca won the title, Monterrey had been the best team all season. And then in the final, Pachuca was just able to kind of jump up and knock them out. There was a little bit of a rift in the team at that point. The Copa America Centenario was coming up. Carlos Sanchez left early to go to Uruguay. There was a player injured. So I think as long as they can avoid something like that happening, and who knows what that would even be at this point, but always possible, I think it's theirs to lose. And I actually really like their chances this time around. And I haven't felt that way about a Mexican team for a long time because it's always a little wild in the postseason. But so far, it looks like they're the absolute team to be.
Sounds good. And then one thing I wanted to point out a little bit of was, I think it's Moriela, the club that America is playing against. In Mexico, it's very much like South America, short leashes on these managers. Do you find that the Monterrey keeping their manager around for what seems like higher than average has made a big impact on developing this talent? I know it's a mix of some new players this season, but also some internally developed talent. Do you kind of see this as like a redemption for their strategy of sticking with their coach?
I think so. There were people that wanted him gone around this time last year, and he signed a contract extension instead. And, you know, like I said, like people are, oh, what are you doing? You guys are crazy. But Mohamed has sort of absolutely redeemed himself. He's gotten a little bit of help from the directors as well. You know, Aviles Hurtado was one of the best players in the league last tournament for Tijuana. He gets picked up by Monterrey pretty quickly. They made a couple other additions that have been enormous to their success. But it certainly seems like, you know, him sort of having that continuity has helped. It's definitely helped his players understand an idea that, as I mentioned, isn't just playing a 4-4-2 and rolling it out there and seeing how it goes. The other great example of that is right across town at Tigres, where Tuca Ferretti has been the coach for a very long time and just signed an extension as well. He's been there for, I think, 7 years at Tigres, and the closest coach after that is Diego Alonso at Pachuca, who's been there for like 2 years, maybe 3 years. I think he's coming up on his 3-year anniversary with Pachuca. So, and Mohamed is right after that. So when you look at the longevity of coaches, to be there for 7 years when the two, you know, the second and third place guys don't add up to hit 7 years, it definitely speaks to, A, how good Ferretti has been as a coach, but also to the fact that, yeah, you know, he has had bad tournaments. And even I remember I was in Monterrey for the CONCACAF Champions League final when it was Tigres America 2 tournaments ago. And I was talking to some Tigres fans. Oh, we're tired of Ferretti. He's very predictable. They were very close to missing the playoffs that tournament. They ended up finishing 8th. And getting out to Monterrey, which is unacceptable. That's a crosstown rival, right? But that's what happened in the playoffs.
Yeah.
So they were very much like, get this guy out of here, whatever. But the, you know, club directors were like, get out, you know, you guys are crazy. Like, this guy's been a club servant for a long time. And he has. And he's doing well. And he's done well. So I think that when you look at those two managers together, it does give a little credence to trying to stick with something, even if it doesn't win you the championship every single tournament.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's interesting that you talk about the fan base as being just as rabid as they are everywhere else, and even more so. It's a crosstown rival. They lose to them, but club hierarchy comes through. I guess that's a little bit of a different from South America, where they would just bring in the next hot young person they could that maybe knows what they're doing.
No, absolutely. And the other thing that's in Mexico, like, it's similar to, you know, even the Premier League has trouble with this. And I think maybe even La Liga. But, you know, Sam Allardyce gets the Everton job, and Tony Pulis. These old dudes just keep getting jobs. It's the same in Mexico, but it's like old bad coaches. Like, at least some of the, like, he's, at least Allardyce, it's like, well, you know, he saved a bunch of teams from relegation. Tony Pulis, like, well, you know, he played some, you know, got some good results out of a Stoke team that didn't have much talent back in the day. Like, some of the guys who keep getting jobs in Mexico, it's like, what's going on? But a lot of these young players, partly because of the pressure, I think, as soon as they sort of age out of playing and retire, it's so much more lucrative and so much of a more pleasant life to just become a commentator, go on TV, or just do something that's not coaching and doesn't have everyone pissed off at you all the time and asking for your job. So it's a shame, because you mentioned, you know, bringing in these young guys, and that's what happens in Argentina. That's what happens in Chile and Colombia, I think, to some extent. But in Mexico, that doesn't really happen. It's usually we fire this guy and bring in some 65-year-old dude who's been at 13 other teams before, has never won a championship. And then you wonder why you don't win the championship the next year. Well, you know, it's because this guy has never, either never been required to learn the skills because he just keeps falling into jobs, or he's just not a good manager. You know, sometimes it's not the right fit. So that's one thing where, again, I think sometimes, you know, giving a coach a little bit of a longer leash is much better than being so reactionary.
Yep. It's a little bit like college football almost.
Yep. Absolutely.
So off of that, I would just kind of transition to that. These other players that retire going to be a commentator is much more lucrative. There's been a huge push lately with the United States not making the World Cup to increase the role that players have that kind of feel like they understand the game better than some of these administrators into getting more involved in the administrative roles in football. And one of the things that I was kind of curious about your take was, if, I don't know if you read the Das Reboot with Raphael Hollenstein's book. And so he really stresses the importance of qualified coaching before it was before anything else, as well as identifying talent. And I'm kind of curious, and since you've been covering Mexico, both they and the United States, I feel like have improved in their youth national teams since probably like 2013, 2014. What steps Mexico taking that America maybe isn't to identify some of these dual nationals, as well as somebody like a Jonathan Gonzalez who maybe just gets spotted and picked up, but gets the right situation that maybe the United States could take from. We're definitely a bigger country, but Mexico is no small spring chicken when it comes to population size. So talent identification.
Yeah, not at all. When you talk about a small country, I mean, Mexico is also enormous, and they have, you know, I've traveled throughout a lot of the country, sometimes for football, sometimes for fun. And, you know, you end up in some places where it's like, oh, wow, like this is, you know, economically, this city isn't doing so hot. This town isn't doing so hot. So, I mean, I think that can be very difficult to scout as well, right? There's not video of these kids from some of these pueblitos coming through. You got to go, you got to find them, and et cetera. You know, I think some of it is the culture that in Mexico, there's just, you know, everyone grows up playing the game. But I also think that gets a little overblown sometimes. I think we use it as an excuse in America to say, well, you know, everyone's playing basketball. Yeah, I guess. But like, we also win the Olympics in random sports that you've never watched before until the Olympics, you know? So I don't see why there's any reason why as many kids play soccer as there is that we couldn't identify, do a better job identifying talent. It's not easy. One of the things that Mexico has that I'm not sure how you replicate in the U.S. is just competition between clubs. I mean, a lot of the scouting, and you mentioned the dual nationals, a lot of that stuff is just clubs coming to scout in the U.S., seeing a kid at a tournament, at one of these events that Alianza de Football or some of the other organizations put on. And, you know, these kids get offered a contract, they get in a system where they can play games regularly because there's the U17 league, the U20 league, in addition to the first team. And there's also even a league where once you've aged out of U20, the Segunda Premier, which is essentially the third division, where it's mostly guys between the ages of 20 and 23, 24, sort of maybe a last glimmer. You know, if you show something at that age, maybe you get promoted to the first team. So I think that competition is a huge motivator for Mexican teams to find a kid and sign him for a low price before you have to buy him from one of the smaller teams that found this kid in their backyard. In America, how do we emulate that? You know, we have development territories, and I think it's sort of served a lot of teams well. You know, Real Salt Lake building their academy in Arizona, I think they've had a lot of hits with the Utah-Arizona region. FC Dallas with Zendejas and Aaron Guillen coming from El Paso and some of the other territories that they have, you know, bringing kids to the academy who have played well. But at the same time, there's never any competition for those kids. You know, if a kid grows up in the El Paso system, he's on FC Dallas's developmental territory. So on the one hand, it's been a good system, and I think it's better for humans. It's better for kids to not be having, you know, the New York Red Bulls try and fight for FC Dallas for your signature, and you as a 16-year-old all of a sudden from El Paso, you have to move to New York. But at the same time, like, that competition, I think, makes you have to scout better. You have to be more careful. You have to be sure that you're hitting. And you have to dedicate the resources to going out and finding these kids in these random places. Like I mentioned, the pueblitos and some of the smaller cities in Mexico where maybe there's not a team. Those cities exist in the U.S. too, although it's with the USL's expansion and NASL trying to hang on as well, we're seeing less and less of that. But you know, a market like Memphis is just now getting a USL team. It's not an enormous city, but I guarantee there's some ballers in Memphis right now who, you know, haven't been seen by anybody and aren't getting that coaching that they need because there's no infrastructure in place. And maybe I'm wrong and there's some legendary youth coach in Memphis, but, you know, that's just an example. So but you get what I'm saying, right? Like, I think there's just a lot of things that sort of factor in the U.S. that don't necessarily factor in Mexico because there is that competition, that desire to outscout your rival, to spend your money wisely. And there's also just more money bouncing around in the game. So I don't know. I don't have all the answers at all. But when I look at the two countries, those are some of the things that sort of strike me.
That's interesting. Yeah, I never thought about that. It's a good thing that you're able to kind of claim a territory, but it also sort of disincentivizes you from having to compete for some of the other talent potentially in other areas. I think that'll start changing as we get more clubs like LAFC now has another, or Galaxy now have as a competitor. And we're looking at, I think, Salt Lake's moving their academy back up north and then Barca's taking over that academy down south. So I think bringing in some of these other non-MLS affiliated clubs that still have some name recognition might kind of wake people up and to know that there are other options out there. So that'll be good.
How much of the that do you think has to do with geographical distances between a lot of the MLS teams and their affiliates sending like high school students that they've signed through their academies up to the USL team, but that USL team's like 300 miles away. So like how much does that play a factor at all?
Yeah. I mean, I think it does and it doesn't. Like, it's, I sort of, you sort of have to balance the sort of difference between like making a young kid comfortable and not having like a hard life with the sort of reality that, you know, Tim Vickery mentions all the time on the World Football Phone-In, which is like a lot of these Brazilian guys, part of the reason that they're so good is that they have to support their family. They've been playing on the street, you know, they've had to learn like different ways to play because they're, you know, not in this regimented football system that you have. So, but I don't think, I certainly don't think we want to say, well, in the United States, we need to have more unhappy soccer players. We need to have more soccer players living 300 miles from home because, you know, the coach is in, you know, our coaching and our system and our academy is in Oklahoma City. We're in Dallas, whatever. We don't care. Your family's here. We don't care. Like you gotta, if you really want to be a player, you gotta go up there. I don't think that's the right situation or the right idea. In fact, maybe the opposite. I think that a lot of times some of the, like I said, that family feel, I think helps FC Dallas out quite a bit. So the distance is tough but in Mexico, you know, that would just be sort of shrugged off. Congrats. You're a Club America player. You got loaned out to Necaxa, which is in Aguascalientes, about a 4-hour bus ride away from America, like Ventura Alvarado, the US defender. Good luck. Like, you better show yourself or else you're never going to be a pro football player. And that's like the cold reality, I guess. So I think it's about sort of finding the right place between this is how it works and this is how we are best making soccer players, with making sure that kids are in a good environment. And even adults, once you turn 18 or 20 or whatever, you know, even adults are in a good environment where they're happy, where they're around their friends, where they're able to see their family. Because I think we'd all agree that, you know, in our experiences, you're a much more productive person when you're a happy human being. And if you get shipped off 300 miles from home and you have to stay there for 9 months to, you know, be coached on a minor league team, I don't think you're going to love that. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
No, yeah, it's just an interesting balance and something I just was thinking about with some of the young players on our roster.
I mean, I would go back, that example you give, Dustin, I would go back to Landon Donovan's first, everybody remembers him for San Jose and LA, but his very first team he ever played for was in Germany when he was like 17. And he went over there and flopped after a really good 90, I think it was 98 or 99, like U17 World Cup. And it was all because he basically was homesick. And when he got back to LA, in California, he was kind of the man. And it felt much better to be, and he was just comfortable. And so by the time he finally went back over to Germany, they were kind of like, well, that, yeah, you're great, but like, why weren't you doing this when you were in your prime?
That's a great example too, because there's no player I think that we've seen in the US system that's shown how important it is to be in a good place mentally than Landon Donovan. So, you know, yeah, at Leverkusen, it doesn't stick. And even when he goes back a second time, it doesn't necessarily stick. But when he's in Northern California and then Southern California, he's balling out because he's among people that he wants to be with.
Yep, I would. Yeah, he always sticks in my mind. He's the number one example of what happens when a player isn't mentally ready. And then the exact opposite is Christian Pulisic, I would say.
Well, right, and that's the other thing, though, is that this was before the World Cup failure. There was a round table of reporters with Christian Pulisic, and I wasn't even there. I was up there covering. It was the U.S.-Mexico game. He spoke before, and then I was covering Mexico, but I was sort of pitching in and was transcribing his interview. And they're, you know, the best soccer journalists in the U.S. are at this interview with him. It's six or seven guys. And they're all my colleagues who I respect and love. But essentially their questions were sort of, how do we make another you? And Pulisic, this teenage kid, is like, I don't know. Like, and that's where I think we're at, because A, you can't just, there's no factory for players. I mean, as much as it seems like Germany is one sometimes, and we do need a better development system, there are still going to be kids who have a ton of potential that don't work out. And there are going to be a ton of kids who are, you know, not good. And then suddenly they're 19 years old, 20 years old, 22 years old, and they're breaking through on an MLS roster. So we're never going to get it perfect. And we have to remember that there are differences. Pulisic and Donovan, age differences aside, were just very different people in general, and very different sort of, you can't develop those two guys in the same way. They've both turned out to be phenomenal players for the U.S. and at their time, I realize how silly this is, but at one point in time, and hopefully many years to come, the best U.S. Player of that moment, right? Donovan was the best U.S. player for quite some time. Pulisic right now, I think, is already the best U.S. player and hopefully continues to be. If you had done the exact same, they have very different paths, right? If you had done the exact same thing with either one of them, it wouldn't have worked. And you almost tried to, right? You had, hey, Donovan, go to Germany, see how it works out. Once you rise through a youth, the Bayer Leverkusen youth team, it didn't work. Something else happened, and then he was good. Pulisic rises through the ranks, and he's good from day one. So I think that's another important thing when we talk about, you know, how to make good players and player development, that kind of thing, is that there is no one size fits all. You're sort of trying to find the framework that sort of best fits the most number of players.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that I like to think and talk a lot more about the psyche of the player. And you look at a guy like Clint Dempsey, who is very much a late bloomer in terms of when he peaked as a player, but at the same time, somebody that continually adapts his game. It shows he's very mentally attuned to the game, whereas some players let that get to them and they experience big drops in form. I think that Christian seems like a very laid back, fairly normal 19-year-old kid. But at the same time, you can tell that when it comes to his game, his athleticism, it's all business and it's just about working hard. And I think that that's an important part of this, especially with FC Dallas, having a parent that is a former player that kind of shows you what works, what doesn't work, is that work ethic is what sets apart the guy that's going to maybe play a couple years and then fade out. And then what's going to really separate somebody who's going to make it. So that's interesting that you have it that way. I'll get you out of there on this. It's a pretty easy one. It ties back to Mexico and America. And that is, will we ever see a team like Chivas here in the United States fielding only American players? And will that team not be owned by Donald Trump?
You know, it's kind of crazy. Trump... He like wanted to own the New Jersey Generals back in the day, or did own them, and like ruined the USFL, and like very clearly wanted to be an NFL owner, but was never like invited to the club. And it's just like, how, I don't know. I think I can feel that that's sort of been an underanalyzed many, if possible, because I'm sure he's been analyzed from every possible perspective. But like,
I forgot it, but didn't he want to start the like Extreme Football League or something?
He was definitely on the USFL.
And I think this like, hey, the richest of all dudes, not being like accepted in the like rich old dudes club, I think that probably like did more psychologically to him than we realize. Would he, you know what? He used to play soccer in high school as well. And his kids apparently in the DC United Academy. So, it's funny. I like the joke, but would he field a Chivas-esque team of all America first? Maybe that's what you call it. America First FC. First of all, no, that would be a marketing disaster. Second, I just don't think so. I mean, I think where the game is at in the U.S. and you know, Trump aside, I think where the game is at in the U.S., you see so much success from these Argentine guys that get brought in, these South American players that come here at a young price. I think we're going to see more and more players from Europe moving here in their prime, like a Giovinco, like a Dos Santos, like Gignac did with, from France to Tigres. I think that is sort of the next step of MLS's evolution, along with more young American players. But I don't think Chivas, it's not a good, it's actually, I would argue that Chivas, and probably Chivas fans listening to this who will not like this, but I would argue that it's bad for development. First of all, they do need to produce their own players, but then when those players don't pan out, they have to overpay for Mexican players. Agents know that they have to overpay for Mexican players because they can only sign Mexican players. So you end up with these teams paying way too much money for guys who are probably average at best, and sort of filling in the cracks. It has in some ways been helpful for the development, but I think they got away with that from that because, you know, you have to have success if you're this great historic team that's sort of waving the national flag as well as the flag of your club. There's a couple other examples of teams that I think would be maybe even better case studies. Athletic, of course, in La Liga, that only fields Basque players, but has sort of a looser definition of Basque than Chivas does of Mexican. And then there's a team in Ecuador that only plays Ecuadorian players. So maybe those would be better parallels, or the Basque thing could sort of hold water here. You know, you could have a team of weirdly, like, you could see like maybe a team of like all Central American immigrants in one of the lower leagues. I could see that happening, but not as club policy necessarily. I just think that the game is at a place where it's very apparent that these teams are often better when there are imports, and the system goes all different ways, right? Like, Pulisic is in Germany, and that's good for the U.S. You know, it's not just, you know, you can only have American players developing here in MLS. And in fact, I do wonder if some of the issues that we've had is sort of an overcorrection to very few players coming through MLS, and sort of, you know, too many moving to Europe too fast. I'm sure, you know, we all remember Breck Shea. Probably would have been much better served sticking around a couple more years in Frisco before he made the jump across the pond. But, you know, that was sort of the era where our mentality was, we got to get these guys over here as fast as possible. What a great move, you know. And I think we sort of overcorrected from that and have not been necessarily encouraging players to go, because in some respects we want to say, look, MLS is a good league and we can develop these exciting young players. Look, we might not like to hear it, but it's probably time for Kellen Acosta to leave, and it's probably time for some, you know, guys of that age, of his generation, you know, even a Paul Arriola who just signed with DC from Tijuana. Like, he, you know, could probably hack it in Europe and probably should. You know, I think that we may be overcorrected because we sent a lot of players over to Europe for a while, and now we're saying, look how good MLS can be. Look at these exciting young Americans that we can put on a billboard, that we can market, that we can have as part of the national team. And I do wonder if we went too far in that respect. So it's going to be fascinating to watch. All that to say, no, I don't think there will be an American Chivas, unless you count Chivas USA, which did not work out at all. So,
all right. Well, thanks for that, John. And I think we're out of time now. I got to go and check out America and Tigres.
Well, Tristan, I've got one more question for John. I just kind of want to go a little meta real quick. I want to talk about, like, your job as a journalist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're just kind of fans that have a podcast here, and we talk and record ourselves. But you get to interact with the players, and you get to know them, and the coaches and the staff and everything. How hard is it, and how do you make that separation between the player? You kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier with Oscar Pareja and how nice of a human he is. Like, how do you make that differentiation between, like, having to cover the player critically and also, like, the player as a human? And
yeah, and I think what you're also sort of alluding to is seeing him the next day, right? I can write something horrible about someone, and then the next day I'm going to see them, and I'm going to have to ask them for, you know, 4 minutes of their time to talk about how the game went. And he knows I wrote that about them, and I know he knows I wrote that about them.
Awkward.
It really is. Even this year, there was a time where I ran into a player at, like, a restaurant who I had just written pretty critically about in the morning news, and I think he knew, but, you know, it's part of the job on both sides, right? The players know that I'm not, it's a lot about establishing relationships as human beings and making sure that I'm never pretending to be anyone's friend, because I'm always, you know, my job is to write the truth. And if the truth is that you're playing terribly, then that's what I'm going to write. And if the truth is that you're playing the best in the league, that's what I'm going to write. Yeah, it is tough sometimes to separate, because you certainly do root for guys. And I think we've all read, you know, especially I think of college sports, where a lot of these times you just read these sort of fawning columns from these good journalists who are writing these columns about these coaches who are clearly in the wrong or out of their depths. You know, you talk about a Paterno situation or even the Greg Schiano thing that just happened at Tennessee. I think you can easily get too close and sort of, like let your relationship with a person or let your sort of desire to see that person succeed because they've been good to you in the past, cloud your judgment. It's difficult. You have to find a balance as a journalist. Like I said, you know, your job is to tell the truth, and your obligation isn't to the coach or the player, but to the reader, to the audience. So it can be difficult. I think one of the biggest things that I try and do is exactly what we are talking about, which is show your face. It's very easy to show, to put out angry tweets, to write angry blogs. It's so easy these days. And then you don't ever have to see the player, and you don't ever have to talk to them. So it does change, but I think it's important to do that. If you're a credentialed media member, to show up and shake the guy's hand and, you know, show him that you're trying to be genuine with him and show him that you're trying to be honest. But, you know, that also has to extend to your reader, because again, like I said, the priority is to them. So it's a balance, to do that, to make sure that, your relationships stay solid, because you don't want a player, you know, never talking to you, although that does happen. But more importantly, I think, like I said, just to stay honest. And I think that if you've shown to the player that you're going to be honest, and when they do well, you're going to write good things about them, just as when they do poorly, you're going to write, you know, that they did poorly. Once you've established that relationship, I think it goes a long way.
Gotcha. All right. Well, we'll let you go ahead and get on with that Liga MX. How do you say it?
I say MX, but you can say MX or Mexican League, whatever. It's fine.
I'm very, very Texan.
Oklahoma, Texas. Wow. I mean, to me, that just means you live in Frisco, but
that's right.
Close.
Nah. Yeah. It should be good Mexican stuff. And I hope everyone enjoys watching some Mexico and maybe learned a little bit more about it. And I'm always happy to answer questions.
Do you have any projects or anything you want to promote before you go?
Oh man. I'm trying to interview every U.S. soccer presidential candidate. So that should be on December. It's been wild on because there, yeah, that should be on Goal. Pretty much anything I do will be on Goal, or if it's a pretty special deal, then I'll put it out and it'll be on Twitter. So, I also did a bunch of stuff for the Mexico World Cup draw, if you're listening to this, before then, but yeah.
Yeah. I read that piece about predicting I read the piece about the lineup for who you're going to take to Russia.
Oh, yeah, who's going to be there, yeah.
I like that.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, but yeah, stuff on the draw and everything, so it's all on Goal usually, and you can find it up there, so feel free to click over.
Yeah, so if you're listening to the show and somehow you don't know who John is, go check him out on Twitter at Arnold, John, and at goal.com. So thanks for coming on, John.
Hey, and check out the World Football Phone-In this weekend, 4 hours worth. John will be there for every minute.
Every single minute. I won't leave early to go to a concert, I promise.
I heard that they told you you're not even allowed to go to the bathroom during the show. You have to be on the phone.
Yeah, and they test you, and they don't they kick you off the show if, like, during the news break, if they're like, hey, where are you? And you're not on there, they'll kick you off. It's pretty brutal.
Nice. All right. All right, John. Well, thanks for joining us.
Take care, guys.